Good morning. First case this morning is United States v. Proctor. Appellant prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court. May it please the court. I am Captain Ryan Cirkovich, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Brueger, we represent the appellant in this case, Technical Sergeant Eric Proctor. Chief Judge Stuckey, with your permission, I'd ask to reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
Due to the unlawful influence exerted by the preferring commander in this case, the government bears the heavy burden of proving there is no reasonable possibility that a fully informed, disinterested member of the public would harbor significant doubt about the fairness of appellant's proceedings. On this record, and for at least 3 reasons, the government cannot prove this negative beyond a reasonable doubt. First, the UCI was formally communicated to hundreds of individuals within appellant squadron, yet there is no evidence that any meaningful remedial measures were attempted, much less accomplished, to cure the commander's harmful message. Second.
Captain Cirkovich, didn't all of this happen like well over a year before the accused trial?
It did, Your Honor, yes. The commander's call took place in August of 2017. And then the trial was held the following August of 2018. However, that was not when trial was originally scheduled to start. It was scheduled originally to begin on 1 August 2017, mm-hmm. Later February of 2018. It's in the joint appendix, and I can find that site for you, where the judge agrees that February start date for the trial is when it's going to occur.
And the other question I had, you might get to it later on, but I thought the CCA, or maybe it's the government's brief, I can't remember. And that's what happens to you when you get to a certain age. But I thought somewhere I read that there was no evidence that anyone was prevented from actually making a statement or testifying.
Yes, Your Honor. And the CCA, in conducting that analysis, I would argue they erred by placing too much emphasis on personal prejudice, In addition to placing too much emphasis on personal prejudice, they didn't apply the correct framework. So one of the arguments we're advancing in this case is that if you look to this court's decision in Thomas, and later as it was adopted in cases like Gleason and Douglas, I believe Douglas, they described that as the ordinary case, the government bears the burden of proving that access to character witnesses has not been impeded. And here we have clear evidence that there was at least an impediment. We know that particularly from Sergeant MJ. Sergeant MJ avoided defense counsel's phone calls. We know that. We know he did that not only after the commander's call, but after having a second meeting with the commander. And this is of critical importance here, because during that meeting with the commander, Sergeant MJ says, I intend to wash my hands of appellant. Again, Sergeant MJ, critically, is someone the court never hears from, and that's a separate problem for the government. But he tells Lieutenant Colonel MS, I intend to wash my hands from him. And at this point, Lieutenant Colonel MS has an option. He can tell Sergeant MJ, hold on, my words were misconstrued. I do want you to fully support, and by support I mean provide character letters, provide favorable character evidence for your friend here. But that's not what he does. Instead, he specifically tells him, support him, but do not enable him. That's the commander's words. And what does he mean by enabling behavior? By enabling behavior, it's clear from the anecdote he told and from the series of analogies he gave, and one of those analogies is about buying an alcoholic a bottle of booze, that enabling bad behavior meant character letters. And it's clear because that's the message he told his unit by relying upon a personal anecdote from his experience as a junior enlisted security forces member himself. So as he's addressing his unit, saying, hey, listen, if I were you, keep in mind this is what would have happened to me. It would have foreclosed favorable opportunities for me. It would have prevented me likely from being a military police investigator, and it would have caused my commander to question my judgment. That's undoubtedly the message that those in attendance at the commander's call took from their officer, their commanding officer, who, as he himself acknowledged, was for the longest time the only officer in the unit. So with that in mind, we look at the types of character evidence, the types of testimony that the government has produced in this case. They called only 2 witnesses in opposition to the motion, one of whom was a named victim and later government sentencing witness. Yet even he acknowledged the commander's comments were, quote, pretty messed up. And when asked to discuss some of this, there is some, to your point, to your question originally, Judge Sparks, about, you know, what was the, were they prevented from testifying? Well, no, they weren't physically prevented from testifying, but if you look to the testimony of Senior Airman RE, Staff Sergeant AG, they undoubtedly recognize some type of trepidation for testifying. They
kind of a chilling effect, is that what you're
saying? Yes, Your Honor. And we know that because, as this court recognized as far back in 1979 in Rosser, that where there the Court of Military Appeals said that the military judge erred as a matter of law, not just as a matter of fact, in failing to appreciate the inability of a subordinate to properly ascertain for themselves the effect that a commander could have on them. And we see that illustrated perfectly through the testimony of Staff Sergeant AG, who himself asked, will the commander be there when I testify? And then when he is asked to explain that comment by the military judge, he says, I still think it's kind of hard for me to say what I want to say when there's a person in a position of power over me in the courtroom. So we know that he had that chilling effect. The military judge, while paying homage to that language in Rosser, without specifically citing to Rosser, but similar language echoed in Kitts and Gerlich, she fails to appreciate it in this context. She fails to recognize that these statements made by these individuals would actually cleanse the chilling effect. And we know this because no member of appellant squadron testified on behalf of appellant or provided favorable character evidence. Now, this is not a situation where appellant has no favorable character evidence whatsoever. We know that because he provided character evidence from a number of individuals with military backgrounds, including members who had previously served in the 50th Security Forces Squadron with him, but were no longer subject to military control. And so we know that he had favorable character evidence to offer. Another point, we don't highlight this in our brief, but I would point it to the court. If we look to JA at 448, it's the character letter of Mr. N. Mr. N, who works alongside appellants in the logistics readiness shop, says that when people passed through his unit on their way out of the unit, they told him that appellant was a good leader. So there's these other individuals that the court never heard from. Now, I would turn to Sergeant MJ in particular. The complete absence of Sergeant MJ's testimony is, I would argue, the perhaps the biggest hole in the government's case, because the government has the duty, or excuse me, the obligation to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there's no appearance of UCI in this case.
Counsel, before we go further on that, I just want to make clear, you're only arguing apparent unlawful command influence. The government says you've waived actual. Is that correct?
That's the government's argument, yes, Your Honor. And to be clear, if I can explain on that, Judge Maggs, as this court recognized in footnote 5 of Boyce, a determination whether or not there is personal prejudice is a weighty factor that must be given adequate consideration, even in an apparent UCI case. So, yes, this at the lower levels, no argument of actual UCI was raised, and we do not seek to raise an actual UCI claim. But the presence of personal prejudice, especially when we apply the correct framework set forth in Thomas in this case, cannot be doubted. So it is still relevant to the question of whether or not even the appearance has been dissipated.
Well, are you trying to have it both ways? Yeah, you are trying to have it both ways. No, this sounds, ever since I've first read this case, so this is an actual case. I mean, I'm not trying to litigate your case for you, but it seems awfully odd that this is being pursued as an apparent case when it's got actual UCI written all over it.
Yes, Your Honor, I would say, I mean, I think that's emblematic of the problem with this case, that the government cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt in a case that looks an awful bit like actual UCI. They could not.
Well, I mean, it's you guys' call the way you litigated it. It's not the government's call.
Yes, Your Honor, I would say in a case like this, the facts are unique here. So Judge Sparks, as you noted earlier, this UCI claim was litigated significantly in advance to the actual pre-sentencing proceedings here. And I think it's difficult for trial counsel themselves to anticipate the true impact that Lieutenant Colenis' comments would have 9 months down the road. At this stage during motions litigation, it is highly unlikely that trial defense counsel would have been seeking character letters at that point. That's not the crux of what they were doing. They were seeking to litigate the UCI motion. It is unlikely they would have been as attuned to the prejudice that would blossom down the road from the commander's comments. So even if this court declines to look at personal prejudice, for the sake of argument, appellant still merits relief on two other bases. Number one, there were no remedial measures that were taken in this case. That's one of the biggest issues here. And second, all of those witnesses who were called, their testimony is hardly helpful to the government in this case. We look, for example, at Sergeant J.P. Sergeant J.P., who received a letter of reprimand for vocalizing his support for appellant. Now, and I understand that there were some other issues going on in the background, but we need to consider what are the members of the unit seeing at the time of this commander's call. This LOR occurred 4 days prior to the commander's call. There's testimony that individuals were associating this message with appellant and Sergeant J.P. They see Sergeant J.P. removed from a favorable duty assignment. They see that he has to switch his shift. And then you have the testimony of Sergeant T., another individual whom the court never heard from, who says that they had targets on their back now, reminiscent of a similar issue of UCI in this court's Berry decision. That same exact type of language.
So, Captain Sinkovich, you were just referring to relief. So I'd like to discuss that a little bit with you. In your briefs, you say that we ought to set aside findings and sentence if, in fact, we were to conclude that your UCI argument is meritorious. Why? Why should we set aside findings? He was convicted of 90 offenses, 128 and 134. Now, with the 90 offense, it could have been good military character brought it in, but in terms of 128 and 134, he still would have, even if this is meritorious, he still would stand convicted of those offenses. So why should we set aside those findings?
Yes, Your Honor. I would rely primarily upon cases like Gleason and Douglas. With respect to Gleason, this court recognized that even, I guess the procedural or the procedure in Gleason was that the CCA only set aside the findings, and this court went further, the CCA only set aside the sentence, and then this court went further and set aside the findings as well because it found that there was no indication that those character witnesses who were chilled would have been any less likely to testify in findings. In addition, I would note that character for truthfulness and the appellants, those types of affidavits that may have been potentially garnered in this case, may have further informed whether or not appellant would testify in his defense in the finding stage. So those types of character letters perhaps.
Wait a minute, pass that by me again. It would have affected whether appellant would have testified in his own case?
Yes, Your Honor. If, for example.
On the 128 and 134?
Yes, Your Honor. If, for example.
How so?
If, for example, he had garnered favorable evidence regarding character for truthfulness or those types of statements, those types of affidavits or those types of witnesses, if he had an outpouring of support from those in his unit who had that type of evidence, that may have influenced his decision whether or not he would testify in his own defense.
Isn't that awfully speculative for this court to engage in at this stage?
Your Honor, I think ultimately at the end of the day, this is the government's burden to prove. And so,
it's the government's burden to prove, but in terms of a remedy, we fashion the remedy. And it would seem that the 128, 134 offense would still stand. And then it's an issue about how we remedy that in conjunction with the CCA, the Article 66 authority, and so forth.
Yes, Your Honor. And we do agree that our argument in favor of sentencing relief is stronger than our argument for findings. We acknowledge that. One thing I would like to touch upon is that what is perhaps most lacking in this case are remedial measures. You to look at it, contrast this case.
Is that really true, counsel? Because you have characterized the lieutenant colonel's statements on this call in a certain way, but I think the record sort of suggests it's really unclear exactly what was said. And to the extent that airmen went to him afterwards and asked for clarification, he expressly told them to go to the defense, right, and to tell the truth. I mean, doesn't what do you say about that fact that to the extent people were confused, that's the advice that was given?
Yes, Your Honor. A couple points in that regard. First, we are talking about hundreds of individuals who were tainted by the command influence in this case. So while there may have been a couple of individuals who sought clarification from the commander, with respect to Sergeant MJ, who I believe you're referring to, who was told to tell the truth, what happened was the commander's call takes place after Lieutenant Colmes makes this comment about, I just wrote a letter of recommendation for this individual. Sergeant MJ goes to the commander. The commander tells him, support him, but do not enable him. He then completely avoids defense counsel, and it then requires a second meeting by Lieutenant Colmes to say, hey, go talk to them, go tell the truth. At that point, Lieutenant Colonel MS and the government, for that matter, should have recognized that the commander's message was being construed in an adverse way. We can also see it through Sergeant AG, Senior Airman RE. At that point, the only realistic way, apart from calling all attendees at the commander's call to testify, would be to issue remedial measures. And they could have done something as simple as what was done in Douglas, where a letter went out on the command, a superior commander's letterhead saying, I assure you, none of you will face adverse career consequences. This is a far cry from even a case like Biagazi. The government cites Biagazi and says that this case is similar to Biagazi. In Biagazi, even after finding no UCI, the judge, acting as the last sentinel against UCI, still went forward and still issued remedial measures. And indeed, he called forth, he sua sponte called additional witnesses, number one, after hearing from Lance Corporal Calloway in that case. So something this court, or excuse me, the court in this case did not do. And then he calls them out in open court and expresses, I believe you came dangerously close, and he issues a series of remedial measures. The government didn't need to do a whole lot in this case to ensure that there was no taint. They could have had a subsequent commander's call, like what was done in Sullivan. You could have seen some of the types of remedial measures that were done in Rivers. There are a host of options the government had on the front end. But at this stage, they are left to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt with only witnesses who are negative to them.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Jessica Delaney, and along with Colonel Sean Speranza, represent the government in today's proceeding. This court should affirm the Air Force Court on the same simple grounds by which that court did so. But under the facts and circumstances of this case, the squadron commander's clumsy story told at a commander's call a year before appellant's trial did not place an intolerable strain upon the military justice system.
How clumsy do you have to be? This is obviously a really screwed up unit.
Yes, Your Honor. No disagreement.
It's not just that, as someone is recorded in the record as saying, that the commander is pissed about all this stuff. There's other stuff going on. There's motorcycle accidents. There's all kinds of crapola going on here. And the commander just empties it out in this commander, well, I guess it's a commander's call, whatever you want to call it. How do you say it doesn't place an intolerable burden on the military justice system to have to swim through all this?
Well, Your Honor, there's three primary factors for this court to look to. And number one are the military judge's findings of fact. And appellant has never alleged that those findings of fact were clearly erroneous or pointed to anything in the record which contradicts the military judge's findings. And she found both that the commander did not subjectively intend to influence anyone in the court. This court in Berry stated that the subjective intent is relevant in assessing whether there was UCI based upon an attempt to coerce someone or to coerce the court. So on that ground of UCI, the military judge's finding of fact is near dispositive. The military judge also found as fact that no witness changed a proffer of support based upon the squadron commander's statement. No witness testified that they understood the commander's message to be what appellant has argued his message has
been. So let's go through what they did think. We've got a number of statements. I'll quote them. If you support an NCO in trouble, then you might want to rethink your career in the Air Force, end quote. Quote, if you support an NCO, not only might you want to rethink your career, it might put you in a negative light, end quote. Quote, if you support certain individuals, you need to rethink your position in the Air Force, end quote. That was pretty messed up, end quote. So you're saying it didn't have any effect. All these people are coming in and saying, this is, regardless of whether there is some ambiguity in the record about precisely what Lieutenant Colonel MS said, what we know is that a number of different individuals interpreted this as meaning they better not support this individual. when it comes to the trial. So getting to the Chief Judge's point, why doesn't this put an intolerable strain on the appearance of the military justice system?
Well, Your Honor, those are some of the statements that those witnesses said. They also stated that they did not believe they would be retaliated against. They did appear in court, and they did testify. And importantly, appellant...
Well, they did not testify on behalf of appellant. And there are a number of other individuals who were not present at that time to hear this, who did say that he was a very good leader. So it causes one to think, gee, the people who heard this, who then come forward and say, the message I received from my commander is, you better not support him. None of those individuals testified on his behalf. Other individuals who were not subjected to that statement did testify on his behalf.
Your Honor, the problem that we have is appellant's statement at trial that he was not asserting actual UCI. And this court in Boyce laid out very, very clearly the difference between actual UCI and apparent UCI is the personal prejudice to the accused. So when trial defense counsel said, we're only alleging actual UCI when the military judge asked, they essentially stated, we don't have a proffer that any witness was influenced, that any witness will not testify because of the squadron commander's statements. Now, appellant repeatedly said it's the government's burden to prove, but it's only the government's burden once he has made that initial showing of UCI.
The government, in its brief, sort of slithers through this vague notion that you have to assert actual before you could assert apparent. And I don't get that at all. What is the government's theory here?
Your Honor, before getting to the question of prejudice, which is what distinguishes actual and apparent, an appellant has to allege the actual UCI. And when I say actual, I don't mean this court's jurisprudence, but what is the violation of Article 37? What did the commander do that is prohibited by law? He has to say that to begin with.
Well, I said in my colloquy with the appellant that this case had actual written all over it. But they elected not to assert that, and they don't have to. We have never held, to my knowledge, that you've got to assert actual before you can go to apparent.
That's correct, Your Honor. But what they have to do is both assert the actions that constitute UCI and show the connection to their court martial.
That's not the same thing.
It's not, Your Honor, but the issue that we have in this case is that after trial and declining to assert actual UCI and declining to assert that any witness has actually refused to cooperate with defense, appellant then went to the Air Force Court, another court with fact-finding ability, and again did not even so much as proffer that one witness, even one, refused to provide a character letter as a result of the squadron.
Well, nobody from the squadron provided anything, which does look a little funny.
Yes, Your Honor, but appellant at trial did not assert personal prejudice. On appeal with a fact-finding body did not assert personal prejudice.
Then why are we here?
Your Honor, that's a question I could ask appellant easily, because we have two courts which have stated that his court-martial was not influenced.
No, we have the government asserting a theory that I've never heard of before. And saying, you know, he didn't do what he should have had to do. And I've never heard this theory before.
Well, Your Honor, I think looking at the way UCI has kind of evolved, this court has found apparent UCI in cases where there was a fraud committed upon the actual court. So for instance, in Lewis and Salyer, where a military judge was removed as a result of unlawful action and influence on the court. The court found that there was an influence, but the accused couldn't show a personal prejudice because he still had an impartial judge. However, that unlawful influence directly impacted and changed the course of his court-martial. In the same way, unlawful influence that's exerted against panel members, an accused can never show personal prejudice, but his forum has been prejudiced. In this case, the only reasonable connection between appellant's asserted ECI, the squadron commander's call, and his court-martial was on the availability of witnesses. It is unreasonable for the government to have to go out and call all 100 people who were present at a court-martial in order to prove that no witness was influenced. That is appellant's burden to first show some evidence that they were influenced.
Counsel, can I ask for clarification on that point? The CCA kind of blurred the standards a little bit and said that there was some evidence of apparent unlawful UCI, where the standard, as we've articulated, is there some evidence of UCI, not of apparent UCI. What is the government's position on this? Is it the government's position that that test was not met because there was no evidence of actual UCI, that first step? Is that the government's position?
Your Honor, I agree that the Air Force Court opinion is incredibly unclear, and it's not clear whether they erred in determining that they could go to prejudice without determining whether the government had abutted UCI or whether they just didn't address that. Your Honor, I can't answer your question as to what their ruling was.
And what is the government's position? Was there some evidence of UCI?
Your Honor, I think there is. It is not unreasonable for a court to have found some evidence of UCI asserted. I do think that the government rebutted beyond a reasonable doubt both the assertion of UCI that the squadron commander intended to influence the court and the assertion that the court was actually influenced. And the Air Force Court was silent on whether the government met its burden on that initial predicate inquiry. It's just silent and doesn't address it.
And can I ask you another question that's a little unrelated, which goes to prejudice? Counsel for the appellant said, well, we're not arguing actual UCI. We're only arguing apparent. But prejudice, even though it's not prejudice to the accused, even though it's not necessarily required for apparent UCI, it is nonetheless relevant to the question of apparent UCI, and therefore that they have not waived an argument about prejudice to the accused. Is that argument correct?
Your Honor, I would agree with you on that. And in fact, under these facts, personal prejudice counts against the accused when both fact-finding bodies found no evidence of any witness contamination in this case. There is no...
Counsel, let's look at the case law. Let me quote. Quote, the prejudice involved in an appearance of UCI case is the damage to the public's perception of the fairness of the military justice system as a whole. So the prejudice is to the perception. You keep on referring to it has to be personal prejudice. How are you squaring that with our case law?
Your Honor, I think what we have to look at is the additional factors that come up before this court finds an intolerable strain. So personal prejudice is easy.
So can I just ask, are you saying that that case law is wrong, that quote?
No, Your Honor. I think in Bergdahl, this court really got to the heart of it, which is we can look at the UCI and we can look at something that was clearly done wrong. But if there's no reasonable inference that something would have changed in the appellant's court as a result of it, then there's no actual remedy to be granted, no prejudice to be found. And here's the issue here. The appellant is asking for this to be set aside. Every court that has dealt with witnesses...
It seems to me, though, that right now you're conflating two different things, the prejudice in terms of what the ultimate findings and sentence would be, as compared to the prejudice consisting of not having his own squadron mates come in and testify on his behalf.
Your Honor, he's only improperly prejudiced by squadron members not testifying if they decline to do so because of the squadron commander's
But words. That goes back to the point here. He doesn't have to demonstrate that prejudice. The prejudice is to the perception of fairness of the military justice system. That's our case law when it comes to an appearance of UCI.
And one of the ways that the government and our court system allows...
Now, I'm not saying that it's not a relevant consideration. I'm just saying it seems like you're conflating two different aspects of this in terms of prejudice. Bergdahl was very different. It was prejudice in regard to the ultimate sentence.
Yes, Your Honor. And here, as this court has noted since questioning, and as this court has noted in witness cases, in Sullivan, Martinez, Rivers, Biagassi, it always looked at, all right, there's a remedy we can give when a witness is impacted by UCI, and that's ordering the witness to testify, or ordering the commander not to retaliate, or some of the other remedy directed at that witness. In this case, appellant has never identified a witness who was impacted by this commander's words.
Now, when you say impacted by the commander's words, I've already gone through all these quotes, all these individuals saying, the message I received was, you better not support him because it's going to harm your military career.
Yes, Your Honor, and the military judge found that in the totality of their testimony, they were still willing to testify and that other personal reasons meant that they were not impacted by that commander. That may be what they thought his message was, but that's not how it impacted them. And this court has also noted, in Martinez-Simpson-Rivers, that full adjudication of apparent UCI may be sufficient to dispel the damage to the system. And that's what we have here. We have multiple witnesses who testified, a military judge who issued extensive findings of fact, an Air Force court who exercised its extensive Article 66C authority, and again, found no issues. The facts are out there that these witnesses were not impacted. Now, under Biagassi, if appellant wanted to raise personal prejudice again on appeal, Biagassi makes clear there's a way to do that. But again, it requires him to show the connection to his court-martial and the prejudice that occurred on his court-martial. Appellant's decision to never raise personal prejudice until this body, this court, which has no fact-finding authority, has prohibited the government both from providing a remedy, if such remedy were necessary, and from even rebutting the assertion of UCI.
So you've just referred to remedy. I'd like to raise the same issue that I raised with Captain Sinkovich. If, I'm not asking you to concede this point, if we were to find, in fact, that it was a meritorious claim of UCI, what would be the appropriate remedy that this court should fashion?
Well, Your Honor, and that's the very problem, is when we look at these witness cases, even Thomas and all these cases, it was remanded back to do additional fact-finding and to allow the defense to put on those witnesses who may have been impacted. Here, we don't have any information, none, that there's a witness who would provide testimony on a rehearing that has not been provided to date. There's no evidence of that. And it's certainly reasonable in this case that no witness from appellant squadron chose to provide a character letter when all of his offenses were committed against his squadron members. He assaulted a squadron member when squadron members were present. He disobeyed his squadron
commander. So are you going to get to my question, though? What's the remedy?
Your Honor, the only remedy would be to order a resentencing. The impact of that...
And what type of guidance should we supply to the CCA about how they should conduct this resentencing? Now, under 66, they could either do it themselves or send it back down, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what type of guidance should we give them in that regard?
So at most, it should go back to the Air Force Court to conduct fact-finding to determine whether a resentencing is even necessary. So to find out from defense exactly what evidence they were not able to put on at a resentencing. And at that point, the CCA could make an informed decision as to whether to remand for a full resentencing or whether to reassess the appellant's sentence himself. But at this point, there is no evidence before any court that appellant was deprived of any favorable witness. He has only speculated that he might be based upon an allegation that he declined to raise when he was at trial. In addition, this court needs to look to the actual factors behind the squadron commander's statement. We're not even certain what the commander's statement was. Certainly his message to support airmen without enabling them is a lawful and proper message for a squadron commander to make. He made this in the course of a regularly scheduled commander's call at which he raised multiple other issues. He addressed annual awards, he addressed sexual assault prevention, and this was only one factor, was his message to support
airmen. And the thing that the members of the squadron carried away from this commander's call was that the old man is pissed. And that's in the record. And so if you're a member of the squadron and defense counsel says, hey, can you support a character reference for this fellow? And you know, you just heard that the old man is pissed. What are you going to do? You're a junior enlisted guy, or you're an E5. you're going to run from this thing like nobody's business, and that's what the members of the squadron did.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that evidence isn't in the record, but that's what they did. If that were in the record, if there were...
No member of the squadron provided one.
Your Honor, if defense
counsel... They ran like scared cats.
If defense counsel had so much as stood up and said to the military judge, Senior Airman R.E., declined to talk to us after the squadron commander's call. There would be remedies a military judge could take.
Wasn't required to.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's an appearance case. So the question is, Sixth Amendment, the ability to have people come in to testify on your behalf, as the chief judge has stressed, you've got the commander out there, the message that is received is, you better not do this, it's going to affect your career. Why wouldn't a reasonable person looking at this, knowing the totality of the circumstances, say, as one of the NCOs said, this is pretty messed up, quote unquote. And why shouldn't we then fashion an appropriate remedy? It could be just sending it back to the CCA and CCA saying, even if we were to remove the 90 conviction, even if we were to assume that he would have received very favorable testimony by his squadron mates, he still would have received the same sentence, that's fine. But the issue of letting this stand where the message is sent, you cannot testify on behalf of this person without it potentially affecting your career, that's really problematic in the military.
Chief Judge Tsuke, I see that my time is expired. Please answer the question. Your Honor, this body is not a fact-finding body, and the facts which have been found are that there was no actual influence, and this was a fully adjudicated case in which the appellant never raised it. If this court were to find that an appellant can raise apparent UCI by declining to provide a military judge with evidence of actual prejudice, and then on appeal may merely conjecture as to what members believed, when that's not the finding of fact by the military judge and that's not the finding of fact by the Air Force Court of Appeals, it would enable defense counsel to essentially get two bites at the apple, to allege a lack of facts at trial and then assert them on appeal. And that is not a proper way for the court to conduct justice. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal. Before you start, how do you answer the government's contention that you guys dropped the ball and there's no connection between any of this and anything that happened to the accused?
Yes, Sharon. I think, as the government aptly notes in footnote 9 of its brief, it says it would have been dangerous for the military judge to inquire about whether or not someone would specifically author a character letter for defense. The government itself describes this as a dangerous tactic, and here's why. If, after those 9 months had passed, the appellant realizes that he cannot garner favorable character evidence, he needs to walk into the courtroom and say, Your Honor, I can't find a single member in this squadron who will write something favorably about my client. And that's problematic, because now if the government's doing its job, the judge is going to say, well, who did you speak to? I spoke to Airman Jones, I spoke to Airman Brown. And then the government is going to go talk to those witnesses and say, lo and behold, we found some great new sentencing evidence here, potentially. There is a risk to the defense, and that's a possibility, a real possibility, that that's exactly what happened in this case. And absent the government being able to ferret out that real possibility and ensure that's not what in fact happened, it cannot prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. The government repeats this error in their brief where they set forth a parade of possibles. But possibles do not merit the government relief. Only appellant can prevail if he establishes a real possibility. And as I heard counsel for the government argue, that evidence is not in the record. That's not the type of statement that the government usually wants to say in a case where it has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt something happened. It must prove a negative in this case, and simply has not done so. I do want to touch on, you know, regarding the Air Force's finding of UCI. For three reasons, the Air Force Court did find there's UCI. First, if we look to Boyce, this court uses language that says only if there is no finding or the government does not succeed in disproving the UCI beyond a reasonable doubt, do we then turn to that question. Had the Air Force Court done what the government suggested it did and merely skipped that secondary portion of the analysis, it would have done so through use of preparatory language like assuming arguendo or assuming without deciding. It did so twice elsewhere in the opinion. It used no such language here, and therefore the Air Force Court did find UCI, and that is what is before this court. The government did not certify this question. The granted issue itself says, did the Air Force Court err, and it refers to the UCI in this case. So for those three reasons, the Air Force Court did find there's UCI, and the only issue before this court is whether the government can prove its burden. With respect to what a reasonable observer would view in this case, the reasonable observer ultimately at the end of the day would view the absence of favorable character evidence as facts and circumstances which inform their decision making. They would see that after Lieutenant Colonel MS is visibly displeased in a companion court-martial that he concluded just 42 days prior to the commander's call, in which he said that he called witnesses on the witness list, himself, set up one-on-one meetings to express his displeasure with that case. And then when asked to describe how he felt that she beat the system, something he told the accused in that case, and said that it left him feeling that justice was not served. To your point earlier, Judge Stuckey, what would these individuals who are junior NCOs, seeing the only officer they've known in their time in the Air Force, knowing how he feels about this disfavored airman beating the system, what would they do? They would run for the hills. They would not want anything to do with Sergeant Proctor. They wouldn't want to touch him with a 10-foot pole. And ultimately, that's what happened here. So, and Judge Sparks, to the first question you asked originally about this distance in time, that makes the absence of remedial measures all the more egregious. They had 9 months to fix it, and they did nothing. And the government tasked with ensuring that it roots out the mortal enemy of military justice simply did nothing in this case. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 10:45.